Committee on Environment to order, and we are going to change our schedule a little bit. We are deleting House Bill 2507 at this point to bring it back next week. We will go ahead with House Bill 2948 and ask Representative Krupp to come and testify. Is there someone you'd like to bring with you?
There is. Mr. Chair, if it may please the committee, I'd like to ask Jim Evans to come up.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. It's my pleasure to be before you today with an interesting idea that I think bears some discussion and possible movement from the committee. Jim Evans is a friend of mine here. He can describe his own self as to who he is. He's a lawyer and works in this area in terms of this area of environmental law. Came to me with an idea that seems to make some sense. And basically the concept is specifying that certain legal issues surrounding environmental issues have another step available in the chain of appeal, and that is the opportunity to go to circuit court in an area that is closer to the area that where a particular event had transpired. And he has personal experience as to why he thinks that this is a sound direction to go, and that sounded interesting to me. I went ahead and drafted the bill at his request, and I would entertain your attention to allow him to explain the circumstances that led him to this conclusion.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Evans, and I'm an attorney, and the process that we have now in DEQ enforcement actions is there is a notice of noncompliance and proposed fines that go out to a landowner. Something on their land is not been up to the regulations or the Oregon administrative rules of the Department of Environmental Quality. Their first opportunity to contest that finding of the is to go before an administrative law judge, and the Department of Environmental Quality has a environmental law specialist, and the party can either be represented by an attorney or they can represent themselves. They have an opportunity to present evidence, make assertions of what the law should, how the law should be applied to those factual situations, and to deny that they either owe any penalties because they're not in violation. Of course, the Department of Environmental Quality, through their environmental specialist, maintains that the findings were accurate and just and should be upheld by the administrative law judge. That administrative law judge then makes a proposed findings and order, and at that point the party, the individual, has an opportunity to take that in front of the entire Environmental Commission, Quality Commission, and present exceptions to the judge's proposed order and a brief to support those contentions. At that point, the commission can make a conclusion that either supports the administrative law judge or modifies it or even rejects the administrative law judge. And that's where, at this point, this bill comes into operation. From that point forward, your only recourse is to appeal to the Oregon Court of Appeals. And that is a expensive process. I have provided some notes in regards to why we think this would be a beneficial bill. People who own land and have environmental issues in front of the Department of Environmental Quality are businessmen and women, and they make decisions based on dollars and cents a lot of times. An appeal to the Court of Appeals can cost $10,000 in legal fees. And if your fine is, say, $5,000, you're going to most likely, unless you really have a very strong feeling about it, you're going to make a business decision, and you're not going to end up appealing that decision. So you're going to be basically stuck with what the department or the Environmental Quality Commission decides. We feel that an individual should have a meaningful right of review by a court of law. And when I say a meaningful right of review, that is one that is more financially available to the individual. Because there are more attorneys that are able to go into circuit court, the costs, and it's a little bit less complex and less specialization than a court of appeals legal proceeding, it's generally cheaper. My sense of it would be roughly around $8,000 cheaper. That's a ballpark figure. But that's a significant amount of money. That may certainly be the amount of money that's the difference between being able to pursue your rights or just not being able to pursue your rights at all. We want, as a lawyer, we want to have respect for our laws. And in the environmental arena, we want to have respect for the environmental laws that the state puts forward. And one of the keys to having respect for the law is to feel that you've had a fair process, a fair hearing, to have your fair shot to put forward your evidence in the most effective and meaningful way that you can. You cannot guarantee the results of that, but the more that that process is transparent and in reach of the average individual, the more they're likely to feel like, okay, I didn't get my opportunity the way it came out, but at least I think this process was fair and even-handed. And that's something that I think this bill would promote, because when the Department of Environmental Quality has acknowledged that out of a whole year's worth of these enforcement actions, on average, only two of them get appealed to the Court of Appeals every year. What does that tell you when you have thousands of these enforcement actions? You could conclude that, well, it's absolutely fair and nobody's upset about that. I would suggest to you the reason is simply because of economics. I know the department feels that it would be more expensive for the individual, but I would suggest those are voluntary costs that the person incurs on their own because they feel that they want to have an opportunity in court. We also feel that this would promote better administrative decisions, because at this point, with the Court of Appeals being so far removed from the administrative law judges and the commission because of the lack of appeals that happen, there's really no effective oversight of the commission, or particularly the administrative law judges. My personal experience is that I was confounded by some of the decisions that I ran into by these administrative law judges. And I was, it just seemed to go against just the plain meaning of the statutes, like as in terms of being able to represent yourself or a business partner and their position on that. And their conclusions as to what the facts of the law. There are situations where there was no case law, they literally had to resort to a dictionary to see, and that was the legal quality of reasoning. And we think that having the circuit court in the county with an elected judge is going to promote that responsibility and better decision making. Because that's ultimately, we're not trying to open the floodgates here. We don't want to see a bunch of appeals. We'd rather see better decisions out of the administrative law judges and out of the commission. And we feel that this bill would help in that sense. Also, if you go, when you go to the Court of Appeals, it's an uncertain process. Certainly there's uncertainty as to what the results will be, because there's no certainty in any legal process. But it can also take, at the minimum, 6 months. It kind of goes into a black box, if you will, or the black robes, and can take a year or more than a year. You're basically hanging on tender hooks the whole time. And when you're making business decisions, you want certainty. People want to be able to predict what's going to happen to them. And that we feel that the circuit court would be more responsible to these business owners, these landowners in the county where it's situated. And that, again, goes to the confidence in the overall legal system and the confidence and faith in the environmental laws that we have in this state. We also believe, just in final, on my points, is that we think that it is tantamount and the highest principle in our community, in this state, to have a meaningful right to an elected judge. These administrative law judges, they don't even have to be attorneys. Many of them are not. The environmental law specialists that the DEQ sends into the hearing to oppose the landowner, you do not have to be an attorney. Many of them are not. There's a tendency to have group thinking in any organization. And judges that are elected in the circuit court are there because of their independence, their judicial temperament, their ability to be fair, and we believe that every landowner that is in this enforcement action, that is being assessed a fine, who is being told that they have done wrong before the community and before the law, should have that a meaningful right to present their case anew. That's pretty critical. And we've heard about trial de novos and what those mean and or what they don't, even across this nation in the last couple of weeks. And a trial de novo in the circuit court would be a new hearing where you can present your evidence. You can have, yes, you can have an attorney represent you, and an attorney many times is very effective in bringing out cross-examination, developing evidence, presenting legal theories that a potential pro se person would not be able to do. There's nothing wrong with having an attorney. The difference here is the Court of Appeals, they look at a paper record. And we also have concerns that when a Court of Appeals that's removed from the land, removed from the situation in time and space, when it looks at a paper record, there's a tendency just to rubber stamp it. They have a lot of cases they have to hear all over the state in many different fields of law. And it's easy, you do not see the evidence. You do not appreciate the evidence in the same way that you do when you actually have witnesses that you can look at their demeanor, that you can hear the way they respond to questions. And it's not an effective forum. And I do want to add a couple of things. I have some testimony here from the Department of Environmental Quality, and I think that the first paragraph where they're talking about the language of this bill, they may have some points in terms of whether amendments are appropriate. Happy to work with them on that issue. In regards to the second, I would respectfully disagree with their cost assessments. I think they are really putting it on its head, because essentially what they're saying is, well, if somebody wants to voluntarily appeal a decision, they're not forced to do that. Somehow that's wrong. Generally, when we feel in our society, when somebody voluntarily incurs a cost because they feel something strongly and want to have a hearing in court, we don't stop them. But it seems like the Department of Environmental Quality would do that in their opposition to this bill. They have indicated also that, it might be inconvenient for people to travel or something in regards to the land. Well, at this point, none of the stuff that they're talking about would change in regard to this bill. The initial appeal, the initial process, the administrative law proceeding, the review in front of the commission, that would all be in the convenience of the landowner right now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a little problem with Mr. Evans referring to amendments that we haven't seen.
I apologize. That's.
We'll bring you back if you'd like to make some comment afterward. Thank you.
So just in closing, I appreciate your time and attention to this matter. We think it's important. We think it has relevance to a large number of landowners out in the rural communities and people that we want to keep involved in our environmental laws so that our environment here in Oregon and the respect for that rule of law is promoted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to recap briefly, I also want to thank the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Justice. We're both in our office yesterday chatting with Jim and I about this issue. They had some further discussions, and we're not there in terms of agreeance, as you can imagine, but I think there's an opportunity for some continued discussion here. The points to remember here is that what we're doing is we're inserting another opportunity in the law for a landowner to decide if they want, after an administrative law judge decision, that instead of going to the Court of Appeals, they could go to the Circuit Court first. And that costs less money to the landowner for a number of reasons. And secondly, I think that it is, while the department will tell you that, yes, this would probably increase their costs, justice is never cheap. And if justice is being denied because the cost of going to the Court of Appeal outweighs the cost in the decision-making of a landowner of doing that versus the judgment, then we've forced them to make a decision that is not necessarily in their best interest in terms of justice. It may be in their, it may be a grudging acknowledgement that they have to make an economic decision, but it may not be justice. So in that regard, I would ask you to carefully consider this concept and flesh it out and see if it has merit to move it forward. Again, we're just saying that there's a cheaper process for the landowner before they have to go to the Court of Appeals. And that there may be some tangible benefits of doing that. We'd prefer if you would very much consider it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Just my own personal comments. Our country, our state goes to extended limits to provide equal justice for those who can't provide it for themselves. And yet we get into a situation like this where people can afford some, but not maybe all. It seems that there is a need there for justice, too. Any questions of Mr. Thank you for being so patient, Representative Garrett.
No. Mr. Evans, all appealed Measure 37 claims are now scheduled to go before circuit courts, which have not heard land use bills in 35 years. Are you sure you want to be able to go to a circuit court and that it'll be faster than an appeals court?
My experience with the circuit courts is that they are expeditious, they are considerate, and we acknowledge that there would be some added burden to the circuit court docket, and that's a concern. But ultimately, this isn't necessarily a opportunity to send a bunch of cases there. It's really an opportunity, hopefully, to have the administrative law judges be more cognizant of their responsibilities. And if that's true, then there really would be no need for even taking that step. But to have that step available is important.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions on a couple of different parts of this proposal. The first one really is, the way this is written, as I understand it, it basically limits this right of appeal from an agency decision to the circuit court only to orders of the Environmental Quality Commission. Should this procedure be available from appeals from other agencies, too?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know that we've looked at the ramifications. Every different department has a slightly different appeals process. They have developed kind of their own. And so we've really looked at in terms of just the Department of Environmental Quality for this.
Okay. Second topic, if I may, Mr. Chair. Would you describe the differences between an appeal to the circuit court versus an appeal to the Court of Appeals? And I guess what I'm referring to are things like, is there a difference in the way the record would have to be prepared? Would there be a trial de novo in the circuit court? Or what? How is it you're going to save money on this process, since most of the effort is getting ready ahead of time for the for perfecting the appeal and getting the materials to the court?
First, in regards to the description, in the circuit court with a de novo hearing, you would be able to present new testimony and have new witnesses, new exhibits. You would be able to rely on the exhibits that were already presented. You could agree to have those accepted by both sides. And in regards to the Court of Appeals, it's strictly a paper record. Now, they at the present time, they call it a de novo appeal to the Court of Appeals. And what that means is that the record is all there in front of the Court of Appeals on paper.
Yes.
And they can draw different factual conclusions than the administrative law judge. And because they draw different factual conclusions, they can make different findings of law. They can also simply say that we think that the original, it's findings of fact and conclusions of law, the original conclusions of law, even if you don't change the factual findings, were in error.
Okay. Here's a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. So you're suggesting then that, in effect, a litigant be allowed to relitigate, to have essentially have a new hearing before the circuit court, you'd be able to, as it were, reopen the record and have a new hearing, essentially have two hearings, one before the administrative law judge and then another hearing before the circuit court judge.
You're right, and my experience in this area was, unfortunately, to be honest with you, was that the administrative law judge was felt free to be arbitrary and capricious. At least that's what my client felt, and in my professional judgment, that I shared that feeling. And so when there's that concern that the administrative law judge was arbitrary and capricious in their findings, we have more confidence in an elected circuit court judge to be fair and impartial than we do in these administrative law judges, and that threat that they could be every step in the process of law, you usually have a higher step other than the Supreme Court, and what that does is it basically makes that fact finder, that person who makes the decision, more cognizant of the laws and the rules that they're obligated to follow in making their decision.
And one final follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Essentially, then, the appeal in a contested case and in an uncontested case would be uncontested cases where we're talking about some other issue, I presume, would be the same under this procedure. Either case, except that in the one case, if the issue involved land in a particular county, went to that county circuit court rather than to the Marion County Circuit Court. Is that a fair summary or not? Have I missed something?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't clear on what an uncontested case is. I haven't really been involved in contested cases. So it's not, I couldn't really tell you the difference between those two things. But at this point, you're not going to go into Marion County Circuit Court under any circumstance, under the status quo of the law right now.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, last question on a new topic, if I may.
Sure.
And that's this. I note that some of the language that your bill would remove from the statutes is language that has to do with the method by which there could be a stay of enforcement of an agency order. Is it your belief that the consideration taken here ought not to apply to these kinds of orders? And what I'm referring to here is the court, before it may stay an order of the commission, will give due consideration to the public interest in the continued enforcement of the commission's order. You're actually striking that material, and I'm wondering if you're really intending that in the appeal process a court can stay an order of the commission without considering these issues.
Well, we think that it's important that the fines not be enforced during the pendency of the appeal, because how they get the money is basically putting a lien on the property. And so they go right out as soon as they get their order if it's not appealed, put a lien on the property. That puts a cloud over the title, and it affects that property owner's abilities to alienate the property, sell it, or make improvements, to get loans from a bank to make improvements to that property. Anything where they're trying to do economic betterment, any kind of lender comes in there and sees that there's a lien on the property from the Department of Environmental Quality, they're going to say no. And so we feel that until a competent court of jurisdiction is made a final decision, that that's, those fines should be stayed.
It turns out, Mr. Chair, that I do have a follow-up.
Follow-up?
If I may. Thank you. Wouldn't this consideration also apply to cease and desist orders in addition to fines?
I'm not as clear about that. I can't really answer that question for you well.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this issue forward. I certainly think we place sometimes people at a real disadvantage in front of administrative law judges and agency hearings. And it would always be in my interest to try to improve the lot as far as the average person out there is concerned in this whole process. However, having said this, and to Mr. Evans, you're talking about I think something of a more timely and judicious way of therefore getting at solutions to the problems. Now, I don't know where you practice law. I assume someplace in the Willamette Valley, if I'm not mistaken. Obviously, you do not practice in my home district. If you've got a criminal case in my district, which in most courts I think pop up first on the calendars, you'll be lucky, unless it's a very, very high-profile case, to get that case in court in a year and a half to 2 years. If it's a civil case, you won't get it in 2 years. We don't have, at least in the district that I represent, sufficient people in the judicial system to handle the caseload that they have at the present time. And while I don't sit on that particular subcommittee in Ways and Means, it doesn't strike me that there is a lot of hope for any subcommittee to come up with a lot of expansions of and therefore more state money going into these. So I wouldn't look for, getting a lot more judges. So I am therefore somewhat perplexed, and I realize it takes time to get in front of the Court of Appeals, too. But if we start adding to the circuit court load, more to the circuit court load now, some of the issues that we're talking about, I think in this building, trying to promote a meth bill that will put more people accused of the manufacture or cooking of methamphetamines more quickly in front of the courts, which most of us in this body, I think, are very supportive and see this as a real epidemic in our society. I'm hard pressed to be able to support adding more load to the existing load or the loads that circuit court judges will have in the foreseeable future.
I can't address your area of representation, but I practiced law here in Marion County for 14 years, and I have quite a bit of experience with that process, both civilly and criminally, as I've done both of those kind of law. And I was very impressed with the circuit court docket here in Marion County how they did move through cases. My experience was that cases did not lag because of lack of judicial time, but simply because the parties had to develop the record through depositions and discovery process, those kind of issues. And I was very impressed with the way the judges in this county were able to move through their docket. And I believe that also it has a lot to do with the professionality of the attorneys involved, too. Hopefully, that's part of any legal process is negotiation and compromise and settlement. So I'm a little bit more optimistic about the judicial branch than maybe your experience. Your experience certainly is, could be different, and I respect that. But I don't think that this is bill would put an unduly burdensome weight on the judicial circuit courts.
Thank you. Representative Depp Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not very familiar with these kinds of cases that you're describing, but I am familiar with unemployment insurance appeals and workers' comp appeals, which do go through a process in front of an administrative law judge. And I guess my question would be, if there really is a pattern of arbitrary and capricious decisions on the part of these ALJs, they are certainly capable of being removed, and it seems likelier that they would be removed than incumbent judges who almost never get voted out of office and rarely are even opposed. So do you actually think that having a circuit court judge would make it any likelier that you would get a decision that would particularly be different or more responsive?
Yes, I do, and I don't think I would have wanted to have this bill brought forward if I didn't believe that. And the simple reason is that when people have oversight, they tend to be more responsible than when they don't have oversight. If people think that somebody is looking over their shoulder, they're more likely to be faithful to their obligations. I think that's not just in the legal arena, that's in all human endeavors.
Madam Vice Chair, could I have a follow-up? Please proceed. Thank you. But do these ALJs must report to an appointing authority, don't they?
Well, their ultimate appointing authority is the governor. And I'm sure there is some input by the Department of, in this instance, in the Department of Environmental Quality, I'm sure has their department head, in this case, Ms. Halleck, has some input as to whether they think the judge is doing a good job or not. I suspect the department likes it when judges rule their way, and I suspect that an individual has less sway over a department head or the governor than that department head has with the governor or the department head over these administrative law judges. I don't think bureaucratic oversight is important, and I think that in this situation, though, what we're really looking at is legal oversight, not bureaucratic oversight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Follow up?
I had a follow up already. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, staff question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Evans, you were commenting on the fact that if this goes to the circuit court, there could be significant de novo elements to what is presented at the circuit court.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at that in terms of your comments about the total cost. If you have a court of appeals appeal that is simply based on the prior record versus a circuit court element that has de novo elements, like, for example, you mentioned a minute ago, depositions. How is it that the cost can be significantly less at the circuit court if, in effect, you are creating a new record for the circuit court that you wouldn't be creating for the Court of Appeals?
The laws of supply and demand. A lawyer who has expertise and experience in the Court of Appeals there are fewer and farther in between. There are many more lawyers out there that just have their shingle on the door and they have experience going into circuit court or going into an administrative proceeding. And so just by the fact that there are more lawyers out there, that has a big impact. And even though it is just on the record, it is a more specialized, if you look out there and you'll go through, and there'll be a ton of lawyers in the Yellow Pages. But you actually get down to how many appellate lawyers are out there, it's a lot less. And their skills, many attorneys are not necessarily paper mavericks, and that's what a court of appeals lawyer is very skilled with paper. You have to put in 25 copies. You have to fulfill the rules that are very strict in the court of appeals. And that's where I come from on that, is economics.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd like to call next panel Eric Moore, Larry Knudsen, and Les Carlo.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Larry Knudsen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Department of Justice. I've been the Environmental Quality Commission's General Counsel for about 10 years or so, and I'm here to testify on what I would characterize technical issues involved with the bill. And we are concerned about a number of what I would consider to be potential inconsistencies or unknowns with the bill. As you've heard previously, this is an amendment to 468.110, which is one of several statutes, only one of several statutes, that relates to hearing rights and the nature of judicial review for administrative decisions made by the Environmental Quality Commission. And because only one of these statutes has been amended, there's a great deal of question and uncertainty about how the others would be affected and what the nature of the judicial review would be and how contested case hearing process might be affected. The Environmental Quality Commission issues a number of different kinds of final orders. As was discussed previously, a lot of these are orders in other than contested cases. They don't involve a contested case hearing. And principally, they involve issues like the issuance of tax credit certificates for pollution control facilities and that sort of thing. The other types of final orders that the Commission issues are the enforcement orders that were largely discussed by Representative Krupp and Mr. Evans. And then they also issue a third type of orders involving issuance of permits. These might be situations where a permit has been denied or conditions put on a permit that a permittee does not like. Most of those decisions involve contested case hearings, but not all of them do. Because ORS 468.110 is a general statute, it is likely that this bill would apply to all of those orders, not just the enforcement orders, and that is one concern. A related concern is, although I don't think it's as likely, it's possible that this bill could be interpreted as precluding the right to contested case hearing for enforcement orders or permitting decisions. And we don't think that that's the intent of the sponsors, and we would like to be sure that that's clearly reflected in the record or amendments made to address that type of concern.
Could you explain that from the bill itself, where it says that?
Well, that's the problem, is that the bill doesn't say that. This bill is, as I said, one of several, Chair Anderson, this bill is one of several that addresses contested case hearing rights and appeals. The principal one for enforcement is in the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act. That's ORS 183-475. And it sets out that when agencies such as the Department of Environmental Quality impose civil penalties. They're required to use this contested case process, and they're required to go through review, which is established under 183.482. And this changes that and says all reviews under 484, but it doesn't say what happens to the rest of the statutes. And so that's part of the uncertainty as to what the effect is. The other statutes, I might add, are cited in the written testimony that I did supply. So assuming that contested cases are not eliminated, which I think is the intent, as the previous speakers testified, the effect of this bill would be to create a fifth layer of review for DEQ enforcement decisions. And I think that Mr. Evans explained how he thought that that would work, and I won't go over that. I think it was, I assume that that's what he's looking for. But the problem is that this bill, in its present form, does not address a number of the issues that either he thinks might be in the bill or we don't know will be in the bill. And those include issues like exhaustion of issues. Does a person need to raise a defense, raise evidence, that sort of thing in the administrative hearing, or can the person wait until it's at the Court of Appeal, the Circuit Court to raise those issues? The issue there is that if, in fact, the Circuit Court is going to conduct an entirely new trial and the person is not required to raise issues before the Environmental Quality Commission and the Administrative Law Judge, there's very little reason and very little incentive for vigorous prosecution of the case below. And that may affect the proceedings in general. As I think was mentioned earlier, almost all of the environmental agencies or the natural resource regulatory agencies use this process of contested cases handled through an administrative law judge and then usually appealed to a board or commission. If not, then it can go directly to the Court of Appeals. And this would establish a different dynamic, and we're not sure what would happen with these administrative cases when they're heard by the administrative law judge and the commission. There's one other issue that I'd like to bring up with respect to the what I would call the venue provisions in the bill. As was noted, the bill would say that if real property is involved, which is usually the case, that all orders must be heard in the county where the property lies. At present, people who file for review of a case in circuit court have a choice. They can file where they reside or where their principal place of business is, or they can file in Marion County. So it's really up to them to decide which is most convenient for them. This bill would take that away and essentially say it's going to be where the property is located, regardless of whether or not that's convenient. In some cases, it's probably the same court. In some cases, it may be convenient. But there are lots of situations where that may not be the case, and it may be, in fact, not convenient for a business owner that has property in a remote county to try the case there as opposed to where the business office is. Thank you. And I'm certainly available for any questions that you might have.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Les Carlo. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor in the Office of Compliance and Enforcement at the Department of Environmental Quality. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 2948. The department's opposing this bill for several reasons. First, because of significant ambiguities in the text of the bill, it's not clear what the bill does. Regardless of the intentions of the proponent, it may or may not change the manner in which a person might appeal a permit decision. It may create a new additional level of appeal, eliminate DEQ contested case hearings outright, or make them moot or redundant if a new trial is to be held at the county circuit court. The legal effects of the bill are uncertain. Second, the bill would add a costly court proceeding to the appeal process for DEQ enforcement notices and possibly DEQ permits. Under the current administrative process, a person appealing an order pays no costs or fees for a hearing in front of an administrative law judge, and no costs for an appeal to the Environmental Quality Commission, which you heard earlier is DEQ's oversight board. The bill would likely mean that petitioners would have to pay court fees and costs to challenge an agency order. Furthermore, under the current process, individuals may represent themselves, and other kinds of entities, such as corporations, may be represented by non-attorney officers and employees. In fact, the non-attorneys can represent themselves effectively in administrative hearings because the rules of order in the administrative proceedings and the rules of evidence are largely flexible and informal. Because the bill creates a court appeal, which would be much more rigorous in its process and evidentiary standards, most of individuals and businesses would need an attorney for effective representation. Although the bill appears to be intended to bring the appeal venue to the locality of the petitioner, it would require some petitioners to travel from a home or office to a distant county where the violation allegedly occurred. In the current administrative process, we work to schedule hearings in a location that's convenient for both the department and for the party, and can even hold hearings by phone if the parties wish. The bill would also create new costs for new involvement by the Department of Justice that do not occur under the current system. Because of court involvement, DOJ attorneys would need to prepare the cases, handle the more complicated and potentially costly discovery processes, travel to the local jurisdiction, and try the cases. These increased court costs add to the burdens of the regulated community, inserting their rights to due process, and add to the state's costs of administering the appeals. They also may add additional burdens to the county circuit courts, many of which already have clogged dockets. This would result in the delay of cases. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. We'll have questions in just a minute.
Hi, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to provide information today regarding House Bill 2948. My name is Eric Moore. I'm a Deputy Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings. First, I'd like to apologize on behalf of Chief Administrative Law Judge Tom Ewing, who could not be here today. I'd like to first emphasize that the Office of Administrative Hearings does not have a position on whether or not this bill should pass. I'm here today only to provide information for your consideration. I must thank you for not putting me first on the list. It was helpful to hear the testimony of Representative Kropp and Council Evans regarding the intent of this bill, and that helped, at least in my mind, clarify a few things anyway. That was part of, if we had a concern, is the clarification regarding the text of the bill has been already been mentioned. I won't go over that again. But it really was unclear whether the intent was to remove DEQ from the contested case hearings process and the requirement to appear before the Office of Administrative Hearings, or solely to change the judicial review process. So clarification would be appreciated on that issue. I didn't hear this from the testimony, but if in fact through this process it is later decided that there is a suggestion to remove DEQ from the hearings process, would like to point out that the creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings has led, and this is part of the operational indicator handout that we've submitted today, the creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings has led to a great deal of cost savings and other efficiencies for the state of Oregon. In part, that is due to the Office of Administrative Hearings' commitment to looking for cost savings measures and efficiencies where appropriate. But quite frankly, a majority of the cost savings are strictly due to economies of scale. And therefore, any time an agency is removed from having their hearings heard through the contested case process through the Office of Administrative Hearings, our ability to continue to provide cost savings and efficiencies is reduced proportionally to the amount of hearings and the amount of time spent on those hearings. DEQ is not an enormous or extremely large portion of the hearings done by the Office of Administrative Hearings, but again, any time an agency would be considered being removed from the Office of Administrative Hearings, cost savings could very well be reduced in a proportional measure. Again, thank you for considering this information regarding House Bill 2948. Chair Anderson, if you or members of the committee have questions for the Office of Administrative Hearings on these matters, please feel free to call myself or Chief ALJ Ewing at your convenience. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your presentation. I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2948, and I will open a hearing on House Bill 2943. I'll call first the Honorable Skip Piercy and Glenn Potter. All right. I don't believe we had Ms. Taylor sign up. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, and Councilor Taylor. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and Vice Chair Nolan and the rest of the committee. It's my pleasure to be back in the building today. It feels like old times. But today I'm here speaking as the Mayor of Eugene and in support of House Bill 2943. You're probably familiar that this is Eugene's Toxic Right to Know program, which was enacted by initiative petition and voted in 1996. And the program has been successful in required reporting. It is occurring, and information is being made public. There are 40 Eugene manufacturers now required to report under the program. The program costs about $100,000 per year to operate. Fees paid by businesses cover all of this, and this is very low, reasonable cost for the program because it requires enforcement and public oversight as well as general administration. As mayor, I know of the large amount of support of this program in our community by citizens who value the right to know. Everyone feels sure the program will continue, and they want to be sure the fee burden is shared as equitably as possible. As you might know, in 1991, House Bill 2431 capped the fees. That just took effect in 2004. And has had the effect of more than doubling the impact on small companies, those that can least afford to bear the burden. As you know and I know, we often learn from the experience we have with legislation that we pass. And this is one of those cases where we see the effect on the small businesses. It's overly burdensome. The issue today before you, I think, is fairness and can be corrected by raising the cap. House Bill 2943 that is before you today would raise the cap from $2,000 to $10,000, which would go a long way toward restoring fee fairness that I just referred to. In the current circumstances, only one company would benefit from the cap. There would still be a limit on fees paid by an individual company, no matter how large the company. The bill doesn't remove the cap, but only increases it for the sake of fairness to small companies. And therefore, I'm just here today to say that we think it's an excellent compromise legislation that we hope you will pass. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Councilor Taylor.
Thank you, and thanks, Chair Anderson and members of the committee, for letting us discuss House Bill 2943. I am Betty Taylor. I'm one of three city councilors who serve on the Intergovernmental Relations Committee of the Eugene City Council. And I am reading a statement by Bonnie Bettman, another of the three who had planned to be here today. But I agree with what she said. I'll focus on our interest in repealing or increasing the cap on fees charged to participating businesses. Our Right to Know program has popular community support. In 1996, a healthy majority of citizens passed the ballot measure, which became a part of our city charter. The Toxics Right to Know law states in Article 1 that the people of Eugene do hereby find that A, exposure to toxic chemicals can damage human health and the environment, and B, citizens have a fundamental right to know the identity and amounts of toxic chemicals that are released into the workplaces, air, water, soil, and environment of their community. The voters resolved in Article 4 that, quote, all hazardous substance users in Eugene shall file an annual public materials balance report listing inputs and outputs of all hazardous substances obtained, used, or generated. Our Toxics Right to Know reporting program is not regulatory, as some would assert. The law does not regulate toxics. It only requires that information on the use and subsequent release of toxic chemicals be made available to the public, and that those who use hazardous chemicals support the program by way of a fee structure. There's evidence that one of the principal benefits of reporting is that it requires a business to take a closer look at the practices for use and handling of material, which often results in a shift to less hazardous material or more efficient use of reportable material. This benefits the businesses as well as the community. The tracking and reporting required by Eugene's law provides critical information for first responders about types, locations, and quantities of chemicals on site. Immediate access to accurate information can facilitate appropriately scaled responses to emergency situations involving hazardous substances. The provision of the information on Eugene's website is user-friendly for emergency personnel, business owners, and the public. Eugene's Right to Know law states that hazardous substance users and not the public will cover the cost of reporting information about manufacturers' toxic emissions. The budget for the Right to Know program is minimal. All planning and policy work for the program is performed by the Volunteer Toxics Board, which is composed of equal representation from businesses and industry and advocacy groups, plus one neutral member. There's one staff person who's here who helps companies as they report, helps the public as they work their way through the reports, and supports the Toxics Board. Eugene's Toxics Right to Know program continues to enjoy strong support in our community. Recent council discussions regarding the challenges of funding the program generated voluminous constituent response in support of the program. The issue we are currently grappling with is the city's authority to equitably and adequately collect fees. The $2,000 state cap on fees has resulted in a financial benefit for a couple of very large entities at the expense of many small businesses who've had to make up the difference. The cap cripples our ability to administer the charter-mandated program fairly among participating businesses. Eugene City Council has voted to support a repeal of the fee cap. We respectfully request that you support House Bill 2943 so that we can exercise our authority to administer the charter program with fair and equitable procedures. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Potter. I work in the Eugene Fire Marshal's office, and I manage the Toxics Right to Know program. Mayor Piercy and Councillor Taylor, by relaying Councillor Bettman's words and on our own behalf, have explained the city's support for House Bill 2943. I'll just make a couple of quick points in addition. The cost of the program is something that needs to be kept down, and there's an interest in keeping it down on the part of both sides, those who like the program, those who don't. Those who don't, obviously, some of them pay the fees and don't want to pay more than necessary. Those who support the program do not want it to be seen as overly costly. So there is no intent through this legislation or otherwise to raise funds in addition to the approximately $100,000 that it costs to operate the program per year.
Second point, our approach to this issue is, as has been stated, strictly mathematical. The cap had the effect of reducing the fees for the larger companies, increasing them for the smaller ones because the revenue requirement is relatively fixed. 11 Eugene businesses benefited from that cap. 62 did otherwise. And I'd be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Curry.
I don't know who would like to answer this question, but you're asking us to approve raising fees in a multiple of 5 times. That's, quote, a hell of a rate increase to give somebody. You have a $100,000 program, and I think I heard you just say 72 businesses?
73. Hey.
73? What's the average fee under, if we were to approve this, what would the average fee be, and how much total money do you collect? And if you collect over what you spend, where does the excess money go?
Thank you, sir, for your question. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we charge the businesses on the basis of their size. We are precluded by state law from charging on the basis of quantities of chemicals used. So we charge so much in FTE to these businesses. Before the state cap of $2,000 took effect, the fees ranged from about $10 to $15 on FTE. Once the state cap took effect, the fees were raised to $31.65 per FTE up to that cap. And fees were raised for the majority of businesses. Only those who were on the large side escaped that. In adopting this legislation, should the body choose to do so, you would reduce that rate from $31.65 back to the neighborhood of $15. We would continue to raise the same amount of money.
Well, if I may add, it isn't that we would have more money or that we want more money. We want to do it more fairly.
And if I might add, having conversed with Glenn, we don't make any in excess.
Well, we do. More
that
technically.
Me
now. No, that is correct. Technically, if we wind up...
I think you're in trouble.
There's a mayor here. If we end the fiscal year with an unexpended balance that is rolled over and serves to reduce the fees for the following year.
All right. Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank all three of you first for coming to testify on this bill and to note that Ms. Piercy is my mayor, and I'm very, very pleased that she is. The city councilor represents the ward next to mine, next to the one that I live in. Thank you for being here. The question I have is this one, and that is this. Is this an attempt on your part to raise a bunch more money, or are you trying to simply reapportion the in a more equitable way the fees that you have now and collect a fee that's essentially essentially the same?
We're not trying to raise more money. What we're trying to do is lower the burden on small businesses and spread the costs more fairly. So that is the intent of this legislation, is to replace some fairness that we think we lost in the last legislation that was passed.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
I'm sorry, I've got to come back and ask one more question. Why is the rate based on FTEs?
We, again, ORS 453-4026 precludes a local program that in any way duplicates the state's programs, and it's been determined by the courts that ours does to some limited extent, from charging on the basis of quantity of chemicals, which we might prefer to do. So there was a twofold rationale for falling back to charging on the basis of FTE. One, it at least roughly reflects the ability of a company to pay. That's not a 100% correlation, but there is a correlation there. Two, there we've also identified at least a rough correlation between the size of the company and the amount of chemicals used. We think FTE is about the best we can do short of charging on chemical quantity.
Does the severity of the toxicity of the chemical figure into this at all?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question. No, it does not. And what you identify there is that we'll have issues of fairness in other areas, no matter what we do with fees.
Officer Glenn.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and glad to see you, Mayor Casey, and we are going to see you tomorrow.
Right.
And it's not a long time. I'm supposed to see you 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Right.
I will be there early morning.
Of course.
And I don't know who to ask, but were you able to converse this idea with the business leaders in that area? Are they supporting this, or did you have any chance to talk to them? It's just one side way to do that.
We've talked to, Mr. Chair, Representative Rim, we've talked to businesses both small and large, and again, in all honesty, they probably prefer not to pay any fees. Who wouldn't? But I think they think this is one of the best ways we can go about trying to create fairness, and even the larger company that was at a meeting that I attended said that they would be willing to talk about raising the cap. So that's
Representative Jensen.
Thank you and welcome.
Thank you.
It's been a while since we did fought the Philistines together.
Fine. It's nice to see you.
And I appreciate. I think I appreciate what you're bringing forth and asking the ability to raise the fees so that you can lower the burden on some of those who are perhaps less able to pay. And I wonder, Mr. Chair, with that, I don't know whether you're scheduled for planning a work session today, but I wonder with that on that line if you could provide us, if not all of the fees, the list and ranking of, not necessarily by company, I'm not, trying to identify the companies or anything of that nature, but kind of how it breaks out now and how it would then break out if this bill were to be moved through and passed into law, so that it would maybe give us something visual to look at. With at least I would appreciate that.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It was great to see you all.
Make it back in time.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Lisa Arkin and David Monk. We are going to be running into time difficulties here, so appreciate your keeping your testimony concise.
My name is Lisa Arkin. Thank you very much, Chair Anderson and honorable members of the committee. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Toxics Alliance, and I'm here today to support House Bill 2943. The Oregon Toxics Alliance is Oregon's statewide citizens advocacy organization committed to community toxics right to know programs as the first step in identifying potential public health concerns from exposures to toxic substances. Without knowing what's in the air we breathe, we cannot develop accurate and effective programs to protect public health. So on behalf of the more than 300 members of our organization, Oregon Toxics Alliance urges the members of the House Committee on Environment to approve House Bill 2943. This bill would once again allow the city to set fees for the voter-approved Eugene Toxics Reporting Program that are reasonable and equitable for all participating businesses. Eugene has had to modify the manner in which the fees are assessed, and one change occurred when, because of a legislative measure, that capped program fees for any one company at $2,000. And while at a quick glance this might seem fair, the fee cap has actually placed a significant burden on small businesses while providing substantial savings for a few large businesses. Eugene voters approved the program on the basis that it be self-supporting. while the fee cap has not prevented this from continuing, it has forced the city to charge smaller businesses much more per FTE than is charged to larger participating companies. And for example, the largest company in the program, with some 800 employees, now pays as little as $1.66 per employee towards the program. But conversely, after the $2,000 cap was put in place, the smallest business, with only 10 employees, pays over $31 per employee. House Bill 2943 does not expand or change the toxics reporting program. It doesn't ask for more money to run the program. It addresses the voters' wishes that the program be self-supporting and not burdensome. And it is about spreading the cost more evenly and equitably among those businesses that emit large amounts of hazardous chemicals. And so, House Bill 2943 will once again allow Eugene to establish a fair and equitable fee schedule for the Toxics Right to Know program. Oregon has long respected the rights of local communities to determine the manner in which they run their home-based programs. I respectfully request that the honorable members of the House Committee on Environment please continue this tradition of home rule and support House Bill 2943, and thank you very much.
You.
I have also submitted written testimony from one of the board members of Oregon Toxics Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is David Monk. I am one of the board members of the Right to Know program, currently serving as the chair. I was appointed by Mayor Tory in 2002. I think you've heard a lot of background about the program. It's a mature program. We've had reporting now for 7 years. The access to most of that data is through the city's website. Last year there were over 20,000 visits to that site, so there's a great interest not only locally but elsewhere in the state about the information that's available there, the emissions coming from the reporting facilities. You met Glenn Potter. He's the staff person that runs the program, and I don't think he mentioned he does his half time. It's a very efficiently run program. So we've looked at as a board, we've looked at trying to cut the cost of the program, and we've cut it to the bare minimum. So we've tried that end, and the cost has not risen greatly. So we're hoping that you will support 2943. What I would like to provide you all is beyond this fair and equitable, the need for this bill to make the fee more equitable, give you some what I think, and I hope you would agree, is the value of the program. As Lisa mentioned, the voters, when they passed this, really felt that they had a fundamental right. It's clearly in the language of the Charter Amendment, a fundamental right to this information. And what many of us hoped at the time is that the businesses that would be reporting to the program would benefit from that more precise accounting. And I believe some of them have. We have a local paint manufacturer has reduced his emissions immensely, and he told me personally that was in part because of the impression citizens had of his business when they looked on that website and saw the extent of his emissions. He felt like there was something he could do, and he installed a filter system, which again reduces emissions significantly. Likewise, we hope that other departments within the city, regulatory agencies, and even public health officials would take advantage of this data. Well, in fact, that is happening. We have the Public Works Department in the City of Eugene. We have wastewater looking at that data to make sure what the company is reporting to them is likewise being reported to the Toxics Right to Know program. Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority regulates some of the same businesses that report to the program. While their required reporting is much less specific than is the Toxics program, it allows them again to confirm that the businesses are providing the same information. And then lastly, the Department of Human Services is through Center for Disease Control has received monies to survey databases around the state that would enable them to better characterize exposures and potential risk to communities. And I've spoken with one of the staff people at Lane Public Health, and she submitted comments to the council in an earlier session that we had, and they are looking at that website as a very valuable tool to ascertain potential risk to community members. So, as was said, I think it's serving its purpose in that companies are reporting, the information is available to the public, but also it is really enabling us to better characterize potential risks and protect public health. And so I think we all agree that if we don't know where we are, we can't plan to get to where we want to be. And I think that we need that information so that public health officials can develop meaningful and effective public health tools to protect citizens in Eugene. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Monk, how much of a duplication of already existing state and federal regulations in regarding to hazardous materials is your program?
Chair Anderson, Representative Garrard, thank you for the question. Committee members, Mr. Potter mentioned the legal case that found that there was some duplicative nature from the State Fire Marshal's program. The State Fire Marshal's program is intended to protect first responders, and so it provides information that is where it's stored in the quantity in large volumes. The Right to Know program is a mass balance accounting, and it's very specific about how much comes into the facility at the beginning of the year, and at the end of the year, where has it gone? Has it gone into the air, into the waste system, into the product, or shipped off and recycled? We're hoping to include the recycling in a future, because I think there are companies that have asked for that. So while I personally disagree with the judge's ruling that it's duplicative of the Fire Marshal's program, Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority only requires reporting around criteria: air pollutants, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxides, and VOCs and volatile organic compounds and particulate matter. Again, the Toxics Right to Know program has a list of over 300 chemicals that have been identified as hazardous by the federal government that these facilities are required to report, again, in a very specific manner, that they have to show that at the again, what comes into the facility and where it moves throughout the facility. So I think I hopefully have explained in a way that that you would share my belief that it is not duplicative of either the State Fire Marshal's, DEQ's, or Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority's reporting requirements.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. What judge's decision?
I can't tell you the specific judge that made this ruling, but this is Mr. Potter alluded to that, and that's essentially when the judge found that it was duplicative. The program, Toxics Right to Know program, was duplicative of, in a sense, of the State Fire Marshal's, and prevented the program from assessing fees based on quantity. I certainly could get that information to you, and would be pleased to do so if you'd.
No, I think your explanation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Dunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, as I understood it, there are about 73 companies mm-hmm. that are affected of this program, and if it's increased to $10,000, how many companies are qualified to pay this much fees?
I believe only one would rise to that level. There's only one that paid more than that previously, so there that would. And again, I shouldn't say that even one company would rise to that level. I think, as Mr. Potter explained, the fee would. The cost of the program would be apportioned to the total amount of employees within those 73 companies, and that's how the fee would be assessed. So I unfortunately can't tell you what that highest fee might be, but again, we could get that information to you. I think we'll be able to do that in your request. Chair Anderson.
Follow up. If I'm wrong, please correct me. It is known sometimes that the Eugene area is not the best place to do business. I'm asking you if I'm wrong, correct me. And then by increasing $10,000 fivefold previously to $2,000, does it be maybe seen from the people, the company going into that area, maybe try to stay away even though its fees might be small?
Chair Anderson, Representative Lynn. I don't share that belief that Eugene is not business friendly. I think we do, and I think we all share this. We have a hope that businesses that locate in our community will be respectful of public health. We'll see, and I think many businesses locate because of the quality of life issues for the employees and for the staff that will work at that facility. I don't think, likewise, that a fee of this nature would discourage a company from locating there. I think Eugene has a lot to offer in the way of quality of life, highly educated workforce, and so I don't think, and again, I don't think they would make that the decision based on that fee. And if I can correct, I think a misunderstanding you have is that as Representative Garrard thought, that this is not a fivefold increase. I think Mr. Potter explained that when the fee cap came in, fees raised from roughly $13 an FTE to $31 an FTE. And if they were to go, if the fee cap was to be raised to $10,000, I believe the fees would revert back to around a $15 per FTE. So again, a medium-sized manufacturer might have to pay $500 or $600, up to $1,000 into the program. Larger companies might pay $5,000 for the program. I think that's a reasonable fee to provide the information to the public about the hazardous substances they use.
One comment.
Uh-huh.
Thank you very much for your explanation. I'd like to agree with you, and I'm wrong and you are right in terms of a business friendly atmosphere in the Eugene area. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
One quick question.
Yes. Let's move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor Piercy mentioned that she intended for this proposal to be revenue neutral. Mm-hmm. So if any company pays a somewhat larger fee, is it fair to assume that there are many other companies, she particularly mentioned small businesses, who would pay lower fees under this different structure?
If the fee cap were raised?
Under this bill.
Oh, thank you. Would pay larger fees? No.
Smaller fees.
Yes, my apologies.
If someone pays a larger fee and you're revenue neutral, then someone probably is paying a smaller fee than they currently are.
Representative Nolan, certainly many, many smaller companies are paying much higher fees than they did before the fee cap.
Okay.
So their fees would be reduced significantly. Again, it would go down 50% approximately, even more than that. And there were really only, I believe, 11 companies that truly benefited from this fee cap, two or three in a very significant way. And again, for them, I don't think $10,000 is, when you're a multi-million dollar company, $10,000 is an excessive amount of money. But nonetheless, the fee would not rise to that, even that level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to call the last panel all together. Could I have Jim Cravens and John Ledger, Terry Connolly, and Terry Witt? Up an extra chair, if you will. And sorry to keep you all waiting. You're a very patient crew.
I heard that, Mr. Craven.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. I want to just very quickly provide sort of a little more historic context as to where this fee cap came from, because I don't think that's really been fleshed out here in the hearing. As you heard, the Eugene voters in 1996, in the fall of 1996, passed this new Community Right to Know program. Many of us in the business community who were already supportive of and had helped lobby similar, not the same, but similar programs. We had had a statewide community right to know data collection program since 1985 that's fully funded by fees on the business community. We had had a toxic use reduction law in 1989 that required companies to look at their inputs and outputs and do a better job. So that was already a state law in 1989, as well as a federal data collection, so-called 313 program, where EPA requires, and these are all sort of different subsets of companies. They're not all the same. But so there's a federal data collection program on chemicals. There was a state data collection program on chemicals. There was a state mandate that companies look at their toxic chemicals and try to find ways to reduce their use and production of hazardous waste, all in place prior to the vote in 1996. Now, that's not to say that the Eugene program doesn't have some interesting different whistles and bells. It does, and I think Mr. Monk mentioned some of those. But so we came into the 1997 session, and there were some of us who thought this was duplicative and it was additional effort, and it was very costly for some companies. So we had a real vigorous debate. I'm trying to remember who was here in 99. Lasted up until the final day of the session. It was actually a bill that would have preempted the Eugene program and precluded similar programs from being done in other cities in Oregon. Admittedly, a fairly aggressive concept that did last until really the last hours of the session, did not become law. Subsequent to that, we had a statewide task force to look at these issues involving just most of the people that are still left in the room here, and came down in the 99 session, with another six-month-long debate over this subject. Didn't start with preemption, started with more of a sideboard approach. What do we do with the existing program Eugene, and what kind of sideboards will be put up for future similar programs in other communities that didn't yet exist? Well, that was the debate in 99, resulted in House Bill 2431, which the bill before you today attempts to modify in just one condition, the fee cap. But that bill that was put together in 99 had a lot of pieces to it. It was a vigorous discussion. It passed both bodies and was signed by then Governor Kitzhaber. The only immediate impacts it had on the Eugene program were to reduce the original toxics charter had a $25,000 per day penalty provision. We thought that was a little excessive, so the bill passed in 99 limited that to $1,000 per day penalty. The other parameter that kicked in immediately in Eugene was basically to preclude citizen lawsuits against companies for failure to file data requirements. So those two kicked in. They affected Eugene, and they affected theoretically any other statewide, any other local program. There are no other local programs quite like this in Oregon, I think, as a result of the 99 law, quite frankly. But one other element was put in that impacted the city of Eugene was to say, instead of an unlimited amount of money, to put a cap of $2,000 per facility per year. And that was voted on and approved by the legislature and signed by the governor. We gave the city, or you, the body gave the city 4 years to work that out, didn't impose it overnight, gave from 99 to 2003 a four-year transition period to allow the community to debate how they wanted to do it, make sure it didn't cut off their money overnight. And then that really resulted, finally kicked in the 2004 billings that you've heard about today. So, you know, I just wanted to bring you a little bit of a history lesson. This wasn't just an arbitrary $2,000 cap that this body passed. It was part of a very broad bill that talked about this issue over the course of two sessions. We have a statewide fire marshal data collection program. That bill has a cap of $2,000 per year per facility, and my recollection's a little foggy, but I think the numbers were married to be parallel. If companies were already capped at $2,000 per facility for the statewide program, we thought that was a reasonable cap for the local program in Eugene. And then you've also heard about the lawsuit that transpired. The point of law there about the not charging on the basis of quantity of chemical was inserted in the statewide program way back in like 1987. That was put in. And it was put in by my former boss, Representative Ron Cease,
for the specific reason of not having a proliferation of these programs that would erode support for the existing statewide program. I mean, that was the reason for that. We don't want similar programs being rolled out in community after community when at the time in the late 80s support for the statewide program was still fairly tentative. We had just put in the fee for the statewide program, and then Representative Cease, who chaired the Environment and Energy Committee, did not want that state program to lose support because local communities started doing the same thing. So that was where that point of law came. And then was never really used until it became a point of law when people sued the city program, and a judge agreed that that state law was real, meant what it said, and so Eugene had to find another way to assess the fee, and they went to the FTE charge. So, I mean, I think we're working on the same basic set of data here today. I don't think we differ at all in what's been said prior, and really what I'm here to do is give you just a little context of where that 2000 came from in a broad context, in a multi-session discussion about such programs, both Eugene and other cities. And you know, it seems to me that the city ought to be able to live and manage within that cap, and I understand it is a little bit of state preemption going on here. Obviously that was the point, but the issue about revenue neutral, and we're just trying to move the deck chairs around a little bit. I just have a final comment. Steve Johnson, who's one of the advocates who actually helped qualify and pass the original charter amendment in 1996. I haven't seen Mr. Johnson in several years, but in those clips that we get every day here in the building, I did see an op-ed piece. It must have been from the Register Guard, an op-ed signed by Mr. Johnson proposing a grand expansion of this program in Eugene. It didn't do enough, that we needed to do more chemicals and more data and whatever. I can't remember his all the details, but I do know that he, as one of the architects of the original program, evidently is proposing an expansion of this program. So we do have a little bit concerned about, $100,000, that's going to be the program forever. We're not talking about any changes, we're just reallocating the cap. When I hear the architects and the original advocates talking about this program ought to be made broader and bigger. So that's my history lesson for you today, and if you can do with it what you want. And thanks for the time, Mr. Chair.
All right. Would you like to follow, or John?
I'll be very quick because I know time's getting short. But and I actually have some suggestions. One of the benefits of that legislation, in fact, was it did strengthen support for DEQ programs such as their new air toxics program. That took about 4 years for DEQ to develop. It's extensive. It's expensive. We helped pay for it. It's statewide, and that would have been impossible to do, I think, if we had had a balkanization of a bunch of small regulatory programs around the state. We like dealing with a state agency that has some uniform application across the state and is technically competent. I think if you start ending up with a balkanization, it makes it very difficult for us to support increases in DEQ that are frankly well beyond what is required by federal law, and we support them on that. We also did the same on water. DEQ just put in a new water toxic standards and program. We support that. We support a fee on us, an increase in fee on us, Senate Bill 45, to support that program. We're backing that. We wouldn't do that if there was a balkanization of smaller programs around the state. The 2000 cap also did something else, and part of it was, if this is really important to the community, business is going to pay a lot of money to implement this, a lot, and they do. The community should have some investment, even if it's small, out of their general fund to help support the program, if it's important to them. It was designed, actually, to make them prioritize the same thing you do here. And that is, how important is this to us? Business is going to pay a lot more to meet the requirements of this than the fees. And what this does is say, if this is important to the community, they'll prioritize it. There are a couple of things that could be done to reduce the cost of the program. One of the things that's required in the law is they have to enable companies to submit information electronically. And they've actually done a pretty good job. This is their instruction manual. And you go through the instruction manual, and you do all the calculations. And if you can submit your data electronically, and I don't know if you can yet, then it's a matter of taking that and putting that up on their website. I am absolutely at a loss why, if information is submitted, like from 50 to 70 companies, electronically, and the website has to be updated by essentially once a year, it's an annual submission, why that would cost more than $2,000 a pop. If it does, if they're spending that, I suggest they try to outsource this. Because I think someone would say, the information's coming in on electronically, update the website for 70 companies once a year, and you'll get $1,000 a pop. It's hard to imagine somebody couldn't do that. There are a couple of other things they could do to reduce their costs. We have companies sending in reports for a lot of hazardous chemicals, such as citric acid that you find in grapefruit, zinc, bars of zinc, ethyl alcohol, otherwise known as Everclear, salt, table salt, welding rods, bicarbonate of soda, baking soda, vinegar used in bread, and the most devastating compound of all, oxygen. These are things people are reporting on down there and spending money to do the calculations. I think if they went back through their list and said, what is important, what is not, if this is truly a right-to-know program, and that's the thrust of it, how do you get that information up on the web effectively? There must be some way to do it. And that's really all I have, Mr. Chairman.
John, I didn't get you to report to the record who you are.
I am John Ledger from AOI.
Thank you much.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Terry Connolly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. The Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce is comprised of 1,200 member businesses in Eugene and, in fact, from throughout the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area. Our mission is to promote a healthy local economy, and we are the region's largest advocate for small businesses. And I do, Mr. Chair, want to acknowledge that amongst our membership is a member of this committee, Representative Barnhart. I am here today on behalf of the Eugene Chamber of Commerce to oppose House Bill 2943. This bill comes as no surprise to us. We know the city of Eugene has been pursuing this type of legislation for several years to deal with the funding of their Community Right to Know program. We simply think it is the wrong approach for the city of Eugene and for the state of Oregon. That sentiment certainly comes as no surprise to the city of Eugene. Our opposition to increasing the fee limit has been expressed to them frequently over the years, and even most recently over the last couple of months as there was an attempt to expand the program. And for your benefit, attached to the written comments are our recent correspondence to the city of Eugene outlining our concerns with the program. I also want to mention that last month, Mayor Kitty Piercy did meet with representatives of the manufacturing companies who are subject to this program, and they made it clear to her that they oppose raising the fee cap for the Toxics Right to Know program. Unfortunately, I think she's left. I do want to thank the mayor for having convened that meeting. House Bill 2943 is not necessary in order to deal with what is a City of Eugene problem. Again, increasing the limit on fees that can be charged to Eugene manufacturing companies is the wrong solution to Eugene's problem. Not to mention, we're still waiting for the City of Eugene to prove why the budget for the Community Right to Know program has not been reduced, or why general funds should not be used to pay for this program, especially when the City claims to have the discretion to fund this program in any manner they choose. We believe no business in Eugene or elsewhere in the state of Oregon should have to pay more than $2,000 a year in fees to support a Community Right to Know program, especially when those companies paying the fees are also subject to the huge costs and burden of having to comply with this type of regulation. Increasing the $2,000 limit on fees is contrary to the business retention and economic development efforts and messages that everyone from Governor Kulongoski on down is attempting to convey to small businesses in the state of Oregon and to those companies outside the area who may be thinking of investing here. Another reason why we oppose this bill is because the current $2,000 limit on fees provides an important safeguard to other businesses that one day may become part of Eugene's Community Right to Know program. And now that there is an ongoing effort by some people in Eugene to expand the existing Community Right to Know program to include businesses other than manufacturers, again, this is an important cap, important safeguard. Not surprisingly, we oppose any expansion of this program. We believe that if House Bill 2943 is approved and the program is expanded, then Eugene will become a city where businesses like hotels, recreation fitness centers, and even the YMCA would be charged perhaps more than $2,000 a year to comply with this program. Additionally, we do find it somewhat ironic that those who are supporting this bill on the basis that they're doing so out of concern for small businesses recently spent the first 2 months of this year attempting to expand at least, at minimum, 170 other small businesses in Eugene into this program. And so that's just a little contradictory. Chair Anderson and committee members, those are just some of the real ramifications of House Bill 2493. But there's one more we specifically want to call to your attention. We oppose the amended language in Section 1.3B of the bill. The difference between shall and may is often subtle, but it is a potentially slippery slope. I cannot begin to even tell you the fear that would go through Eugene manufacturing companies if there's even the slightest ability for votes for a fee in excess of $1,000 per day to be assessed to Eugene businesses. Shall not exceed $1,000 per day provides much more certainty. There is no need for this change. In closing, there are far too many unintended consequences with this bill for Eugene and for the state of Oregon. House Bill 2943 is the wrong solution to Eugene's problem of funding their Community Right to Know program. Chair Anderson and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to comment. I will be happy to answer any questions you have.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I can be very brief since Jim covered much of what I had intended to talk about, the history. I would like to just take one step back, and that is that our organization, back before I was even here, back when Dave Dietz was the director, was one of the instrumental parties in actually crafting the original Community Right to Know back in 1985. Interestingly enough, when that bill was implemented in the state, there was no money attached to it. It was sold as a mechanism by which first responders in this state would have access to know what's in the buildings that they're going to under an emergency condition. And everyone agreed with that concept, that is a worthy and noble endeavor, that they ought to know what's in a building when they respond under emergency condition. It wasn't until 4 years later that the legislature was looking for a convenient mechanism to raise revenue that was some way, shape, or form associated with hazardous material or toxic materials. And that's when the concept came about of, well, we have this program called Community Right to Know, and it does a hazardous material inventory. Let's hang some fees on that. And as such, not only did we wind up funding the Community Right to Know program, but we also wound up funding two programs within the Department of Environmental Quality, which were totally separate and distinctly different from Community Right to Know. Even with that, as a prelude to what I'm going to talk about, the State Fire Marshal's Office has done a very good job in keeping its costs under control. As Mr. Craven had mentioned, currently the Community Right to Know program is capped at $2,000 per facility per year for the state's program. The toxic use reduction program is capped at $2,000 per facility per year. And the Superfund site is capped at $9,000 per facility. It seems rather strange to me that a program at the state level can be run for $2,000 per facility, but a program at a local level that is not by law to be duplicative of the state's program needs a cap five times that much. It just seems rather strange to me. And I, too, am worried about the, I guess you would call it, the escalation of the program or fee creep, if that's what you want to call it. There seems to be something that just isn't above board with this whole process. My last comment in looking at the bill, I know they say the only thing we're changing is increasing the cap from $2,000 to $10,000, but there are some other subtle language changes in the bill that on the surface may not appear to be all that concerning. However, Section 9, for example, eliminates the term except as prohibited by state law. One of the programs that is prohibited by state law is pesticide preemption at the local level. And I'm wondering if perhaps this just may not be some way, an end-around type of activity, because we do know that the same advocates that have pushed for this toxics reporting law in the city of Eugene have been pushing vehemently to try to find a way around state preemption of local pesticide regulation in the city of Eugene. That's all I have to say. I do oppose the bill as it is written. I think $10,000 is an unreasonable cap. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to call a question period. We are severely behind time. Appreciate your testimony. It's been very powerful. And with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2943 and adjourn the committee.